too soon? Lockdowns are lifting. We'll take you to Britain, India, and France. Also to Yemen, which only has a few dozen reported cases of COVID-19. But it is a scary situation for this ER doctor.
Honestly, I don't feel secure at all. That's because people are careless. They're thinking that the virus is not coming to Yemen.
And lots of uncertainty about how life will change. One of the biggest questions, how to stay safe in the skies.
All these airlines are trying to figure it out. There's no standard right now. There aren't standards globally. There aren't standards between carriers.
And in Singapore, see Spot? Spot is in the park, off the leash. Spot is a robot dog. Spot is in your business.
For your own safety and for those around you, please stand at least 1 meter apart.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. Today on the show, we're talking life after lockdown, from India to France to Singapore. We begin in the UK. After nearly 2 months, Britain is opening up. Last night, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson laid out the plan.
This is not the time simply to end the lockdown this week. Instead, we're taking the first careful steps to modify our measures.
The government's slogan of stay home, save lives is now stay alert, control the virus, save lives. But there was instant blowback to the slogan and the plan that Johnson announced.
Many people ask the question, well, what does stay alert actually mean? We're talking about a virus. It's not a physical thing. So how do you stay alert to a virus?
The World's Orla Barry is in London.
Then last night, he laid out the plan for lifting the lockdown. And the second big issue that came up is that he said to people who could return to work that they should do so. Those who worked in sectors like manufacturing, construction, food distribution, and food production should return, but added that they should avoid public transport if at all possible. Now, the difficulty is, if anybody knows even London, for example, you'll know that London runs on public transport. So his suggestion to tell people to go back to work was, well, how are we going to get to work if we're not going to use public transport?
So that was last night, Orla. How are people dealing with this today?
Still, there is a backlash and still some confusion. Have a listen to what Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the Labour Party, had to say in Parliament this afternoon.
Does the Prime Minister recognise that the COVID crisis has exposed grotesque levels of inequality within our society? And his statement yesterday has given a carte blanche to many employers to try and force people to come back to work without proper consideration of their health and safety. And does he not recognise that his statement will make the inequalities in this country even worse?
Jeremy Corbyn from the opposition Labour Party. And Orla, it wasn't just the opposition that had problems with the Prime Minister's plan. Apparently, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are not happy either.
No, indeed. And Welsh MP Liz Saville-Roberts put this very point to Boris Johnson in Parliament this afternoon.
There is now a three nations approach. Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland all agree on policy and message. And I mean this with no malice, but for the sake of clarity, can he confirm that in almost everything he has announced today, the Prime Minister is acting as the Prime Minister of England?
Her point being that Boris Johnson is supposed to be the Prime Minister of all of the UK, but he's only acting like he's a Prime Minister of England. So, Orla, with the disagreements about how to reopen, what changes can the UK actually expect to see over the coming weeks?
Well, this week, people have been told they can go out and they can exercise. They can meet one other person outside their household. But other than that, you won't see that many changes. Starting from the 1st of June is when we'll see things like schools starting to reopen and small shops starting to open up. And then it'll be into July before we see establishments like pubs and restaurants being allowed to open. But all of that is contingent on the infection rate not going back up again.
Boris Johnson also announced a 14-day quarantine for passengers arriving into the UK. How has that news been received?
Yeah, it's taken the airlines by surprise, it has to be said, and they've already taken quite a pummeling up to now. The government said that the 14-day period will be imposed on all travellers arriving into the UK, except for those from Ireland, and today they said also from France. But the airlines do appear to be taken aback by the news. And here's the CEO of the International Airlines Group, which owns the likes of British Airways and Iberia, Willie Walsh.
Definitely going to make it worse. There's nothing positive in anything that I heard the Prime Minister say yesterday. So we had been planning to resume on a pretty significant basis are flying in July. I think we'll have to review that based on what the Prime Minister said yesterday.
Yeah, 14 days of staying inside will probably make lots of people rethink their UK travel plans.
Absolutely.
The World's Orla Barry in London, thank you very much for the latest.
Thanks, Marco.
Another country lifting its lockdown, India. The unemployment rate there is now 27%, a record high for the nation. The Indian government is taking a phased approach, easing restrictions only in areas that have not seen infections for a month. But overall projections still show that infections in India have not yet peaked. State hospitals remain overwhelmed and don't have enough ventilators. But as the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, India's government is portraying their response to the pandemic as a success.
When India's lockdown began 6 weeks ago, millions of migrant workers lost construction and factory jobs in big cities. They tried to walk back to their villages, but police sealed the borders. One of the stranded workers, Mohammed Jalal, said it was difficult to find something to eat or a place to sleep. Last week, 16 migrants who were sleeping on train tracks were run over. As the crisis grew, some in Mumbai took action. They began to take the migrants' food. One was a Facebook friend of advertising consultant Mazhar Ramzanali.
And I saw this happening on Facebook, and I told him that this is great work, this is what we need. And I was, you know, almost pontificating on how lovely it was. And his reply to me was, join me, I need your help. And you know, and I was like, oh, shit.
Ramzanali had never volunteered before and had planned to spend the lockdown reading a good book. Instead, within a few days, he was coordinating what he calls a citizens' movement of about 50 people.
If somebody told me that I was not involved, I would not believe that it's possible to do with just citizens coming together and, you know, trying to figure it out.
They partnered with high-end restaurants to deliver simple vegetarian meals to, eventually, 80,000 people every day.
And it was amazing. I feel so gratified.
The Indian government says this is the story of the country's response to the pandemic. Citizens coming together to help all of India's 1.3 billion people. Vijay Chauthiwali directs the Foreign Affairs Department of India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party. He says, unlike the U.S., India's federal government has worked well with its states, and political parties have put aside divisions.
In this hour of crisis, all these political parties have shown enormous consensus.
That consensus among politicians has had an impact, he says. It's helped keep India's number of coronavirus cases low at nearly 70,000. Skeptics believe that number is low because there hasn't been enough testing. But Chauthiwali dismisses those concerns.
India is doing adequate testing, and it is comparable to the other countries like South Korea or Germany, where the disease has been managed very well.
Chauthiwali points to other ways the Indian government is managing the pandemic. It's now arranging special trains to take migrants to their home villages. And officials are also in the early stages of bringing back 200,000 Indian citizens who were stranded abroad when the country locked down.
So this will be the most complex and the biggest rescue operation in the world any country has ever taken.
But the Indian government has critics who present what's happening in India very differently. They're backed up by a new report from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which says Muslims are being persecuted in India, in part with the help of the country's largest newspapers and television networks.
The mainstream media are continuously spreading fake news against Muslims.
Sanjar Alam is an engineer and activist in New Delhi. He says the media have blamed Muslims for spreading the virus.
This Islamophobic propaganda by media and some political leaders has seriously consequences on the ground. They are the main reason, they are the main cause for spreading Hindu-Muslim violence here in India.
Before the coronavirus hit, violence against Muslims was rising in India. Alam worries that attacks on Muslims will go up again once the lockdown is lifted. And he says India's Hindu nationalist government may let it happen, as they have before. Yet Alam feels he has to be optimistic.
We are going through a tough time, but we have hopes here. We No, we will get over it soon.
He says it's a relatively small group of people who are responsible for the increase in religious tension. As the lockdown is lifted, Alam believes most Indians want their country to return to being a place where people of all faiths can prosper. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
One more country now that's lifting its lockdown. France is easing up restrictions today. Some stores can open, restaurants and bars not yet. French people can now move around a little bit more without permission slips or threats of a fine. People can also travel outside of their département, kind of like a county here, if they have compelling family or work reasons. Many, including Mireille Clapeau, say that should also include visits to lovers. Clapeau is a member of France's parliament and joins me now. Your lover's bill got rejected in parliament last Friday, Mireille, but I'm curious what motivated you to propose it in the first place?
Thank you, Marco. Well, in fact, I received a message from a young woman living in my department, and she said she was desperate because her boyfriend was living in northeast of France. She wrote, "I don't understand why I'm not allowed to visit him, or he is not allowed to visit me, because we will be very cautious, and why should people take the public transportation, and why aren't we allowed to meet?" And it was very convincing, and I decided to propose a lover's amendment to allow these people to meet, even if they are not married, even if they have not a pax. A pax in France, it's a kind of official way to prove that you are together. But here, it's only people that love each other, and therefore I propose this lover's amendment.
And so that young woman, was she the only one? Are you hearing about other couples in the same situation?
Well, after the lovers' amendment was rejected in the National Assembly, I got a lot of messages, and I realize now that it's really a strong problem for a lot of people, especially when, for example, the man lives in France and the woman lives in Belgium. When there is a frontier between them, then it becomes very, very complicated to meet.
So the argument for keeping lovers apart is pretty straightforward. We're in a pandemic, and we need to mitigate the threat of disease. Do you disagree with that premise?
No, of course. I think that health is really the first concern for everybody. But now we are not anymore in a full lockdown. Little by little, there are some authorizations that are given. For example, if you wanted to visit your old mother who was ill, or if you wanted to meet your husband that was blocked somewhere else, you could. Just what I want to add is that when you love without a proof of it, without a wedding certificate, it's a compelling reason.
Mireille, will you keep pushing for lovers' rights throughout this pandemic?
Yes, you know, it was not really my destiny, but now I see so many testimonies of people that are desperate. Even somebody wrote to me that it was a matter of health. When you live without your lover, you can get ill. So it could be a public health problem, or it could become a public health problem. So I decided that I would try to help these people. And of course, we hope that very soon the rules will be less strict and that the pandemic will stop. But anyway, it's a fight I want to lead now.
Representing love and lovers, Mireille Clapeau, a member of parliament in France. She represents the department of Drôme in the southwest of the country. Thank you very much, Mireille Clapeau.
Thank you, Marco.
And coming up next, imagine being greeted by a dog in your local park, but instead of this, you get this.
Please stand at least 1 meter apart. Thank you.
Robotic dogs enforcing social distancing. That's coming up. You're listening to The World.
The World's supporters include Subtitle, a podcast about how we speak.
All of human languages are products of human brains and bodies.
We talk with comedians, politicians, anyone who thinks about language. Alien languages, too.
If I were a sphere with 9 eyes or 9 sensory organs placed around my diameter, how would that affect things?
Subtitle. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A dog in a park. No big deal. Now, a dog that walks up to you and starts talking?
Let's keep Singapore healthy. For your own safety and for those around you, please stand at least 1 meter apart. Thank you.
Meet Spot, a robotic dog being deployed by Singapore's government for a two-week trial to help enforce social distancing guidelines. Michael Perry is the vice president of business development at Boston Dynamics, a company that created Spot. So when Spot walks up to people, Michael, and asks them to stand further apart, I know this is just the beginning of a two-week trial in Singapore, but do people generally listen to robotic dogs?
There's a lot of people who are paying attention to what the robot is saying because it's so new and novel. But, you know, it's important to note that Singapore has been trialing other robots, wheeled and tracked robots, delivering similar messages for the past several months. So this is just a new morphology that's delivering this message.
And how do people respond to those rolling robots?
Well, you know, they continue to deploy them, so we can assume that the feedback has been positive. But importantly, in this instance, you know, they're taking people, otherwise people who would be social distancing ambassadors, out of the harm's way of potentially contracting the disease while they're out in public, and putting robots in that place instead to raise awareness.
So I gather Spot can only reach a speed of 3 miles per hour. So like if somebody doesn't social distance, he's not going to chase them down. What will he do? Like how do the enforcers get Spot to enforce?
My understanding is that they're not using the robot to enforce right now, but more generally to spread a message. This is just one application for pandemic response that the Singaporean government's using, including delivering medicine, checking vital signs of potential patients in hospitals. So, you know, there are a wide variety of applications that they're exploring right now.
What about privacy concerns? Because Spot is remotely controlled by another human and there are other people involved in the process. Is there a chance that specific people will be tracked and recognized?
The Singaporean government has clearly said that they're not intending to do that as part of this trial. But more generally, Spot doesn't record data as a part of its mission set. So, you know, it is a flexible platform. You can build a variety of sensor payloads on top of the robot to collect information that's relevant to the whatever the application is. So we've seen, for example, hospitals mounting a thermal payload on the back of the robot to start looking for body temperature, respiratory rate, heartbeat of patients that might have COVID-19.
So aside from roaming parks and doing all these tasks associated with the pandemic, is Spot good at doing anything else? Can he do tricks? Can he roll over and kind of play dead?
Well, we, you know, Cirque du Soleil has been looking at applications for Spot as part of their stage shows. One of our customers has started creating viral videos of Spot doing funny things on TikTok. But critically, the robot has the potential to take people out of harm's way. And that's primarily the application that we see most valuable, whether that's in response to a pandemic, doing bomb disposal or hazmat incident response, or even doing something as mundane as documenting progress on construction site to improve scheduling.
Michael Perry, the vice president of business development at Boston Dynamics. They are responsible for Spot, the robotic dog who's roaming around parks in Singapore, making sure people are social distancing. Michael, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Since the coronavirus outbreak began, we've been paying special attention to lessons learned, not just from this outbreak, but from past outbreaks of other disease. Here's one case worth looking at again, Malaysia in the late 1990s. Kyle Vass has a story of the Nipah virus and how it helped prepare Malaysia for today's pandemic.
Pigs were dying, people were getting sick, and everyone knew the two were somehow connected.
Initially, this was something no one knew what it was.
Tom Hughes is a scientist with EcoHealth Alliance in Malaysia. He says at first, the Malaysian government thought there was just a bad case of Japanese encephalitis going around, a disease spread by mosquitoes.
The Malaysian government quickly realized that wasn't the case, and they were dealing with something new, something that hadn't been seen before. And it turned out it was Nipah virus.
The virus got its name from Sungai Nipah, the small village surrounded by jungle. Farmers raising pigs there planted fruit trees to make a second income. And Hughes says the fruit attracted flying foxes from the jungle, also known as bats.
They fed in these fruit trees, they dropped chewed fruit, they urinated, they defecated into the pig pens. And this virus that had been carried by flying foxes for tens of thousands of years was able to move from the flying foxes into the pigs.
At first, the virus from the bats wasn't a threat to pigs, but random mutations and constant exposure to this new species of animal allowed it to adapt and jump from bats to pigs.
The pigs amplified this virus. They made this virus stronger. so that it could then infect humans.
It's a process scientists call zoonosis, when a disease moves from animals to humans or the other way around. When the Malaysian government learned about this new virus in pigs, they shut down pig farms and killed almost a million animals in a single day.
And that ended up decimating the Malaysian pork industry. It cost the economy $550 million. If we could go back 5 years before that outbreak and educate that farmer about the risk of planting those fruit trees, which seemed very innocent to him, we could have prevented this outbreak from happening.
More than 100 people got sick and died from the Nipah virus. Most of them were pig farm workers. In a documentary from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Yi Ah Moy holds up a picture of her deceased husband. I was also really worried, she says. We were told it was mosquitoes. My husband said, mosquitoes? What's there to be afraid of? Tom Hughes is part of a movement called One Health. It brings together veterinary scientists, epidemiologists, public health officials, economists, and ecologists. Their goal is to prevent outbreaks of zoonotic disease.
The One Health concept is pretty simple. It's something that my children are able to grasp, but it's something that grown-ups seem to struggle with. And that is, if we want to have healthy people, we need to have healthy environment, we need to have healthy livestock, we need to have healthy wildlife. We are all interconnected.
Hughes says Malaysia's eradication of Nipah virus was an early example of how this approach can work. As for COVID-19, Malaysia only has about 200 cases per 1 million people. That's just behind South Korea. Hughes says the country's relative success is directly related to its history of fighting zoonotic diseases.
Just looking at how Malaysia is responding to COVID-19 and how well we are doing to maintain the spread of this virus, and how they are doing an amazing job keeping the public informed, really shows just how well Malaysia has embraced these kind of ideas and really is showing itself as a regional leader in dealing with zoonosis.
Hughes says it's the responsibility of wealthier nations to fund zoonotic disease research in these countries because, as COVID-19 has demonstrated, we are all in this together. For The World, I'm Kyle Vass.
Tomorrow, we continue our live weekly series on the pandemic, taking your questions to the experts. We ask Joseph Allen from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health how to safely reopen workplaces. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org and watch the conversation live at 12 noon Eastern on our website. That's theworld.org. News headlines are coming up next. You're with The World. As restaurants reopen, we might need to get used to saying this, table for one.
If you want to go out and eat by yourself, it's kind of frowned upon, right? People will look at you as if you're a loser of some sort.
Not in Sweden. Finding ways to eat out, stay healthy, and not feel like a loser. Coming up here on The World. A few months back, when we first learned about this new coronavirus emerging in China, we were basically told to watch out for two things, a fever or a persistent dry cough. So much has changed since then in terms of what we know about the symptoms of COVID-19. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. And Alana, it is now more than just a fever or persistent cough. What else are we learning about other symptoms of the disease?
Researchers are learning that there's a lot more symptoms and that it can vary quite a lot. So Tim Spector is a professor of genetic epidemiology and a doctor at King's College in London. Here's what he has to say.
We've also got chest pain, abdominal pain, shortness of breath, hoarse voice, confusion, diarrhea. And important ones are fatigue, anorexia, and loss of smell and taste. And there's a few other ones we've added recently, like acute muscle pains and hives of the face and skin rashes.
So, Marco, these symptoms are way more than what you might find on a list of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control or on the NHS website in the U.K. But what he has been doing is leading this symptom tracking project where millions of people in the U.S., the U.K., and now Sweden have been self-reporting symptoms through an app.
Globally, are they finding any common trends in the symptoms?
Well, one surprising finding they published in the journal Nature today, Marco, is this loss of smell and taste appeared to be more common than they had thought. Andrew Chan is a doctor at Mass General Hospital here in Boston and at Harvard. He's also leading this symptom tracker study. And he told me that a majority of people they found had this sort of unusual lack of taste smell symptom who had also tested positive. And he says this knowledge can really help better identify outbreaks.
Our understanding of the symptoms has changed as a result of the data we're collecting. And that has been returned in real time back to public health authorities as a way to better track where we're actually seeing incidents.
Marco, I do want to add one point of caution to all of this, which is that with real-time tracking, it's so essential. It's this massive sort of citizen science initiative when you think about it, but there are limitations and weaknesses. So, for example, they're only hearing from people who have the ability to download an app and they want to use it. So that really misses young people and old people who don't have phones. And also it's self-reported. So if we start hearing a lot about certain kinds of symptoms, like a loss of smell, people might then be reporting more of that because that's what they're hearing about.
So a loss of smell and taste, how would that differentiate from, say, allergies?
So on an individual level, Tim Spector tells me you can't really differentiate it. But what he and Andrew Chan and others are doing is looking at the population level and also looking at clusters of symptoms that could be an indicator. So for people that hadn't been previously experiencing symptoms and then have combinations of things like abdominal pain plus acute loss of smell plus then a sniffy nose as an example.
There are also some surprising developments, even for scientists, and we haven't even gotten to other symptoms we're hearing more about, as in how COVID-19 is impacting some people's organs and blood circulation. Do we know why this is happening in some people?
I think, Marco, first off, we have to have a certain reverence for this virus and how much scientists still don't know and how much they really want to know. So again, Tim Spector, the genetic epidemiologist at King's College in London, he says he's just still really struck by how varied this virus is and how it can manifest in our bodies.
In my career, I've never seen any virus that or any disease that is quite so variable, has such a variable effect in people and can affect nearly any part of the body as well.
And so he's really trying to keep an open mind as people are reporting symptoms. But that being said, there are some things that he's keeping an eye on in terms of why symptoms might be manifesting in this way. One might have to do not with the virus itself, Marco, but how our immune systems react to it or overreact. Again, he's also a geneticist, so he's looking into genetic variations in people. And one way you can do that is actually by studying twins. Another thing he's thinking about has to do with our guts and our microbiomes. But of course, I can't help but think of the other factors that go beyond the biological when we think of things like social inequities and differences in health systems in terms of why some people might be developing more severe symptoms and problems.
The world's Alana Gordon. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
One continent that has not been as hard hit by the coronavirus is Africa, but some experts suspect the low numbers reflect a lack of testing. Enter a team of researchers in Senegal. As Rebecca Rossman reports, they're working on a home test that could produce results in as little as 10 minutes.
As the world started shutting down in mid-March, the head of the World Health Organization sent out a simple message to countries.
Test, test, test.
Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says you cannot fight a fire blindfolded. But producing a quick, reliable, and affordable test that can easily be distributed isn't easy. In Senegal, one group of researchers is working on a solution for the entire continent.
Our purpose is to make benefit all African countries.
Dr. Amadou Sall heads the Pasteur Institute in Dakar, the Senegalese capital. His team is working in partnership with a British biotech company called Mologic. Together, they're developing a 10-minute rapid detection test that could be available by early June. It's actually two tests, a saliva swab for people who think they're infected and a finger prick for people who want to know if they've had previous exposure to the virus. The tests will be sold at cost, which is about a dollar, thanks to grant support from the UK government and the Gates Foundation. And the entire test, results included, can be done at home. No need for a lab with fancy equipment.
So in this regard, in African contexts where you have fewer labs, this is a huge advantage.
Reaching a remote population is one of the biggest challenges to achieving widespread testing in Africa. About 60% of the sub-Saharan population is rural. Once approved for manufacturing, the test kits will be made at a newly built facility in Dakar. According to Sall, it could produce up to 4 million test kits a year. Michel Yao is the Director for Emergency Response at the WHO Africa. He says having a test that can be manufactured in Africa is crucial in order to solve another important hurdle, market access.
African countries have less access to the global market because these items are mainly manufactured in developed countries, including in the U.S.
But there is another challenge to achieving widespread testing in Africa.
Fear and suspicion.
Bronwyn Bruton works with the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. She says in many countries, people don't trust the government, including the officials who work in public health.
In the case of the Ebola outbreak, in DRC in particular, in Central Africa, there have often been cases of communities attacking healthcare workers who come to try to administer vaccines and testing because they fear that these people are actually there to deliberately spread disease.
Another factor that goes hand in hand with fear is stigma.
We saw this with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. People who test positive for this disease are stigmatized.
Last month, a group of people in the Ivory Coast capital Abidjan burnt down a COVID-19 testing facility over fears that the center could become a vector for the disease, spreading it to the neighboring community. How countries grapple with stigma, Bruton says, will take more than an effective test.
It's a tremendous societal challenge. And to be completely fair, this is hardly something that's restricted to Africa. You know, if you read the newspaper in the United States, you'll see reports of terrible xenophobic attacks on people of Asian origin. In Africa, people are no different. And there's some basis for fear when you're talking about coronavirus because it is highly contagious.
Amadou Sall, for his part, says he's focused on the immediate task in front of him. Producing a solid at-home test that can be distributed to as many people as possible.
So what we're feeling is a high sense of responsibility and a commitment to support our continent and our countries.
We're in it now, he says. And once you're in it, all you can do is fight. For the world, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
Iran's navy appears to have accidentally hit one of its own ships with a missile, killing at least 19 Iranian sailors. Another 15 were reportedly injured. The incident took place on Sunday during an Iranian military exercise in the Gulf of Oman. American ships are deployed in the Persian Gulf nearby, which raises concerns about the potential of an accident like this actually sparking conflict between Iran and the U.S. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
The first images of the incident appeared online last night. Here, emergency crews can be seen scrambling to help the injured on board the ship. It's dark, but at least one man can be heard moaning, likely from an injury. Details of what exactly happened are still emerging. The Iranian military put out a statement saying that the ship was part of a naval exercise when it came too close to a target. A missile struck the ship instead of the target. Marla Carlin is with Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
Friendly fire events happen in every military. They're awful, of course. However, what's important is that we understand what just occurred in the context of what has been happening with maritime security more broadly in the Gulf.
Carlin has advised 5 U.S. Secretaries of Defense and worked on Middle East security issues at the Pentagon. She says tensions between Iran and the U.S. is nothing new, but in the past few months, their armed forces have been involved in more competitive and heated tit-for-tat exchanges. Carlin says it doesn't help that the two countries have no direct communications.
They don't understand where the red lines are for their opponent. And I worry that this lack of understanding is dangerously escalatory.
Last month, President Trump tweeted something ominous. He wrote that he has instructed the U.S. Navy to fire on Iranian gunboats that harass American naval vessels in the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, right next to it, are important commercial routes, not just for the U.S., but for the global energy market. In the past, Iran has threatened to block the ships that pass through this area. And this isn't the first time that the Iranian military forces have come under scrutiny for deadly mistakes. In January, Iran's Revolutionary Guard accidentally shot down a passenger plane, killing 176 people on board. Families of the victims say they're still waiting for an investigation into what happened. Adnan Tabatabai is a political analyst based in Germany. He says it's too early to draw conclusions about the incident on Sunday.
The vulnerability of Iran's military apparatus, both to human error, but also to potential cyber attacks. So this is certainly something that can go both ways.
Meanwhile, on Monday morning, bodies of the victims from the Iranian ship were returned to their loved ones. Now, Tabatabai adds, Iran has two deadly accidents to answer for since the start of the year. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Yemen, just to the south of Saudi Arabia, has been shattered by a regional war for more than 5 years. The humanitarian situation in Yemen has long been dire, with many people living on the edge of starvation. Then the pandemic arrived. 6 weeks ago, Yemen recorded its first case of COVID-19. That patient has since recovered. Now, 36 other cases have been reported in Yemen. 7 people have died from the virus, small numbers relatively speaking, but Michael Ryan of the World Health Organization said they don't tell the whole story in Yemen.
We believe that the virus is spreading at community level, and we need to focus on providing essential health services and COVID-19 services to all people in Yemen.
We asked a doctor in Yemen to record his thoughts about COVID-19 during his overnight shift in an emergency room.
My name is Nader Durafi. I am a medical doctor. I work in the ER department in Sabr Hospital in Aden. The time is 12:30 here in Aden, and the ER is still crowded with patients. Most of them complain of fever, dry cough. Some of them have difficulty of breathing. Besides the epidemic of COVID-19, there are 2 other epidemics here in Aden. One of dengue fever, the other is chikungunya. Most of the people here are suffering from a fever these days. And with the lack of test kits, we can determine who has COVID-19 and who hasn't. The medical staff, the doctors, the nurses, everybody, they don't have enough protection for themselves against the virus. Honestly, I don't feel secure at all. That's because people are careless. They're thinking that the virus is not coming to Yemen. One of the reasons of that is that we're not testing for the virus. So as long as we're lacking the test kits, we'll never know the actual number of the infected people. Bringing home the virus. That is my major fear. Especially that we live in an apartment with my father, who has a history of heart disease. But what we do for protection, the masks, the eyeglasses, the full uniform, I mean. I keep sanitizing my hands every 5 minutes, keep a safe distance while examining the patients. But 100% protection is not guaranteed.
Dr. Nader Al-Durafi, an ER doctor at Al-Sabr Hospital in the Yemeni city of Aden. A spokesperson for the World Health Organization said today that 803 tests have been conducted across Yemen, a country with a population of nearly 30 million. Let's see, the last time I was on a plane was 7 months ago. That may be a record for me, and it doesn't look like I'm going anywhere anytime soon. It is mind-boggling. Airlines have gone from raking it in to now losing tens of millions of dollars a day. Passenger traffic is off more than 90%. Among all the unknowns, the future of airline travel is a big one. Josh Solera is a global airline consultant for the advisory firm Egon Zehnder. He's in Houston. So aside from getting flights going again, Josh, is there kind of a calendar for survivability? Like how many more quarters does the industry have to get through before things look like you need a new scenario plan?
Everyone's really looking towards October 1st. The government has given the carriers a bailout between now and then to continue operating. If passenger traffic doesn't improve substantially before then, I think October 1 could be a really big reckoning day for the industry.
And when you say a really big reckoning day, what is the industry going to have to kind of face up to on October 1st?
A lot of leaders have publicly come out and said, we're going to have to cut jobs, we're going to have to cut flights, we're going to have to change the way in which we operate fundamentally in order to continue to be able to survive. For right now, they're continuing operating flights that are, not in many cases, not profitable. And that's going to have to shift on October 1. They're cutting down costs, but they can only go so far until October 1st.
There's a big difference between international routes and smaller domestic routes. One can imagine that passengers' decisions about international travel will be taken more judiciously than before in the future. At the same time, you can also imagine shorter domestic routes may suffer because people may just opt to take a train or drive. What routes and what carriers are most vulnerable, do you think?
You're absolutely right. There are differences between short haul and long haul. Getting on a plane from, say, Houston to Tokyo is going to feel very different than getting on a plane from Houston to Dallas. And you are right. People are reconsidering which routes they're going to take, whether or not that flight is really necessary, and what it's going to mean. And while you may be able to, say, on a short haul flight, not have food or beverage service out of safety, that's really tough on a long haul international flight. And so carriers are having to think not just about what did they do, but what did they flex depending upon the routes. You know, carriers who have short haul are going to have challenges. Carriers who have long haul are going to have challenges. Those challenges might look a little different, but no matter what, the airline industry, no one is immune. No carrier is immune from this right now.
Realistically, as long as the world does not have a vaccine, how do you see the future of the aviation industry?
I think you're actually going to see a lot of innovation. Some of it's going to work, some of it's not. People are blocking middle seats, people are thinking about staggering, people are thinking about do we even change the way seats are fundamentally structured on a plane? In some ways, there's going to be more innovation in the aviation industry because of this than there may have been in some time. At the same point, you're likely going to see some carriers continue to struggle. You've seen recently a couple more declare bankruptcy just in the last couple days. So it is going to continue to be a hard time. Those leaders who are able to inspire confidence in their employees, who can inspire confidence in the travelers that they are going the extra mile to make them keep them safe, to keep them healthy, and to make them have a truly good experience, are going to be the winners in this.
Josh Solera, a global airline consultant for the advisory firm Egon Zehnder, thanks very much for your thoughts on this.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Things are going to look very different in the coming months. Restaurants, for example, waiters wearing masks, throwaway menus, maybe even plastic divides between tables. One new pop-up restaurant in Sweden has adapted in a unique way. It's called Bord för en, or Table for One. Exactly what it sounds like. One table, one chair. To ensure safe distances between customers, that table is in the middle of a meadow. Rasmus Persson is co-owner of Table for One. He joins us from Ronsetur, Sweden.
If you want to go out into a restaurant and eat by yourself, it's kind of frowned upon, right? People will look at you as if you're a loser of some sort, maybe a date yeah. stood up or something like that. But for us, the sole act of eating is like, it's an amazing experience. And also in these times, it feels like everyone on my Facebook and everyone in every feed that I have are like frustrated and dying to go out there and meet people and socialize. And I get it. I'm the same. But we have no idea when we are able to do that. So instead of channeling the frustration, we wanted to do something where we say to everyone that, like, it's okay to spend time with yourself. You're worth spending time with.
I hear wind around you. Are you in that meadow right now?
Yeah, I'm standing in the meadow right now.
And so I'm imagining I'm a diner in that meadow. What do I see around me?
You would see green grass is starting to grow here in Sweden. And right now the sun is shining and, you know, the cherry trees are blossoming a little bit behind us. And it's beautiful that just a couple of weeks ago, cows were roaming these fields. So it's also kind of a circular experience. You
circle
get to eat
life.
On the same service as the cows, basically, which I like.
How much does it cost to dine at Table for one person?
We realized instantly that to start a restaurant with one guest each day, you're never going to make any money out of that. So instead, we decided to pay tribute to the fact that a lot of people are facing huge obstacles right now in life. People have lost their jobs, for one, but a lot of people have lost their loved ones. And what we wanted to do was have this experience cost as much as you as a guest feel that you can spare, basically.
I'm looking at a picture of one of the tables and chairs in the meadow. It seems like it would be actually a really pleasant experience, almost introspective. What kind of experience do you hope guests have?
I think you're right on the money there. We're really trying to have this be an experience where you travel within yourself. Each course will also be curated with a poem. We've had friends help us to pick out poems, and we want to do our best to make sure that every guest that we have this summer have a respite, is that what you say, or like a break from all the stress and drama in life that everyone's facing right now.
Rasmus Persson is co-owner, along with his girlfriend Linda Carlson. He's also chef of the restaurant Table for One in Sweden. Rasmus, thank you very much, and good luck with the restaurant.
Take care, man.
Here's where we ask for the check. Don't worry, I'll get this. You can always find us online at theworld.org. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.